Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Tanya Jeffries. And coming up, inflation bounces back. How worried, though, should we be? With speculation over changes to ISAs, should you put your extra savings in a pension instead? Also today, the government scraps its update to its online state pension forecast tool after outcry from rather baffled This Is Money readers. Premium bonds are looking, well, less premium. And are you a nationwide current account holder? Make sure you listen in. Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, inflation is back at 3%, higher than the expected 2.8%, and is predicted to go even higher in the coming months. So how worried should we be? January's figure was a big jump from December's 2.5%. So are we headed back to the dreaded double figures of recent times? What does it mean for our money, the economy and the government's plans? Tanya, Simon, welcome. Simon, if you would talk me through January's figures, higher than expected.
Yes, that had people a little bit rattled. There were concerns about this word stagflation again, which is the stagnant economy, the lack of growth combined with inflation. Now, there were some things in the inflation numbers that certainly didn't look pretty. And there was a warning that came alongside them, actually, from elsewhere. But on the flip side of that coin, you've got the Bank of England having already said that it expects inflation to go higher than this anyway, and appearing to be relatively unconcerned about that because it sees it as being temporary. And you also have the slowing economy. What is unfortunately very fresh in people's minds is an inflation spike so severe that it was dubbed the cost of living crisis, which central banks and governments also initially thought was going to prove to be temporary or transitory, is the favoured word amongst the economics geeks. So what did we have underlying this? Firstly, the nasty stuff. So inflation was up. Core inflation, which strips out volatile energy and food prices, and alcohol and tobacco, because they're just basically tax, jumped to 3.7% from 3.2% in December. Not something people were looking for. Services inflation, that's again another thing that the Bank of England and economists keenly watch, that climbed from 4.4% to 5%. And what's concerning there, obviously, is with services, you don't have the same kind of raw inputs going in. So it's less controlled by external factors and it's more controlled by internal UK economy factors, which is why the Bank of England's rate setters do look quite keenly at services. The services make up a huge part of our economy. And then you've got food prices. Food prices help push up inflation. They're a particular area of concern. Food inflation was 3.3% in January. That's the highest since last March. Meat, bread, cereals, driving price hikes. Now, what the worry is here is that shoppers have been warned that food inflation is likely to get worse because supermarkets and retailers are passing on their own higher costs that were delivered by the autumn budget. They're going to see their wage bills go up substantially from April when they're hit by a double whammy of the employer national insurance contributions hike and also the national minimum wage going up. And underlying this appears to be a sentiment that they're going to let prices drift higher. They're not going to be trying to keep prices down as much as they possibly can. And actually, although food prices have risen a lot and supermarkets have been accused of profiteering off the back of the cost of living crisis, there was quite a lot of stuff going on with those big grocers, the Tesco's, the Sainsbury's, the Aldis and the Lidls of this world that kept food inflation lower than it could have been. With the Tesco and Sainsbury's stuff, you've got the price match thing that they do with Aldi and Lidl. That kept a lid on prices. You've also got those huge club card and Nectar prices schemes, which, you know, there's some argument as to whether they actually bring down prices or just hike prices for people without the cards. But the penetration of those cards is really quite substantial amongst customers. So you could argue that they are keeping a lid in some way on price rises. And then you've also got a report from the grocer this week suggesting that some of that price match stuff is being pulled back. Supermarkets have already made lots of noises about their increased costs. They've been laying off people and everything like that. So that makes for gloomy reading. The bit that the Bank of England has focused on before now, before I stop talking about inflation, for all of you people thinking, when's he going to shut up? He's inflating the amount of words that he's using here, is energy prices. The Bank of England has already said that it expects inflation to go up 3.7% this year off the back of rising energy prices. We had more news this week on that. One of the most accurate forecasters, Cornwall Insight, now predicts that the energy cap will go up to £1,823 from April. That's up from £1,738 now. And more importantly, it's up from £1,690 last year. Bank of England thinks that what we're looking at is price rises against base levels last year. That means inflation is going to go up, but then it's going to go away. Economists at the NIESR actually agree with this. And they are suggesting that underlying these measures, inflation doesn't look so bad. And the other thing that contributed to it is something that most people will not pay: school fees.
Of course.
But if you do pay them, they've gone up a lot due to VAT.
They have indeed. Firstly, Simon, don't worry about the extra words. It would be really dull podcast if you didn't speak. So happy for you to carry on with that. But I do want to just jump back ever so slightly to the food, and then we'll continue on with inflation. You mentioned there about cutting back in some of those deals that they've been doing, the price match. We've got Sainsbury's has joined Tesco recently. They've cut the number of products available in its Aldi price match scheme. Do you think that this is part of a wider issue of them scaling back some of these things, or a Sainsbury's, who I've seen quite a few adverts for its Nectar cards and the way that it's pricing things up now, is it just putting all of its attention into that?
There's a bit of deck chair shuffling that goes on with this stuff. Cut the prices here, push the prices up there. I mean, supermarkets are businesses with shareholders and also executives who want to be paid very large amounts of money and are paid very large amounts of money. And the way that they get paid more money is by sales and profits going up. They are not in it for the general good, whatever they tell you. They do have a responsibility to those shoppers, though. And I would say that even the multi-million pound men, normally men, but the multi-million pound men and some women at the top of these businesses will probably somewhere have a feeling of responsibility towards shoppers and not just gouging them as much as possible. But they are facing higher costs, and they're coming off the back of facing much higher costs, a lot of which was passed on due to, you know, the inflation that they were seeing in the products that they buy before they put them on the shelves. But they did go into bat for consumers in some places, particularly on branded products. I mean, the greedflation thing, you know, with the makers of brand name products shoving up their prices by more than the cost of, you know, their own inflation and profiteering off the back of it. And the big supermarkets called them out on that. And you then look at Aldi and Lidl, which, you know, to be honest, make up a really big market share in this country now. There's a lot of people who've switched to them. And that has, you know, to an extent, kept a lid on prices. But there isn't really much they can do about that double whammy of national minimum wage going up and employer national insurance contributions. And it's not just that the rate of employer national insurance contributions is going up. It's also that the threshold at which they have to start paying that is going down. So they are going to see a big bill off the back of it. And we've seen, you know, unfortunately, job cuts. We've also seen something that Lee Boyce has commented on, a massive rise in self-service tills. It's almost like the second summer of self-service till love going on here. Like, you know, we had the initial wave where supermarkets, you know, went absolutely mad for self-service tills. And then it sort of like eased off a bit. And then all of the supermarkets I go to have now basically wiped out half of the remaining tills and shoved self-service tills. Why do they do that? Because they don't have to pay them. They certainly don't have to pay them the minimum wage or national insurance contributions. So I think there's a kind of readjustment going on here. I don't know how bad this food price inflation is going to get, but I would expect it to go up a bit more. And the problem is that actually we're still facing those higher prices from the last round. It's not
Quite,
like they
quite.
went up and then they went down back to the level they were at. We're still facing those much higher prices.
I mean, that's the thing, isn't it, Tanya? That as much as inflation is not as high as it was, as much as we're not looking at the 11%, I think it was in October 2022, it's not like they've gone away. Everything's just so much more expensive. So how worried should we be? It's not just food, it's everything.
I think we should be quite worried. It might not spike as high as 11% again, but a lot of things are pointing in the wrong direction. And one of the more immediate things is what's going to happen with interest rates. I think it might be a bit more wait and see if we're lucky rather than cuts, potentially rises, but hopefully not as this progresses. But a lot of the issue with deciding interest rates is looking ahead to what might happen with inflation. We've got Donald Trump threatening a tariff war, which I think pretty much all reputable economists are agreed would be inflationary. He seemed to row back on it slightly, but it's hovering out there. And I think we'd be foolish to think that he wouldn't go through with it at some point, even just to prove that he wasn't bluffing. We could suddenly wake up in the middle of a tariff war. I think also there's been a big step change in the last week in terms of geopolitics. It looks like defense spending is going to go up a lot. We are probably going to have to spend a lot more on defense. Lots of other countries are going to have to spend more on defense. That is inflationary. So it's not just looking at the core inflation and the figures that are important right now. You have to look ahead as to what's coming down the line, and none of it looks good.
I mean, if the last 5 years have taught us anything, it's that instability is probably here to stay. So how can you protect your money in this sort of environment?
Well, I think that firstly you have to take the position that the Bank of England and the government aren't going to do you any favours. Now, they might do, obviously, but I would start from that position. The Bank of England's doing the best that it can, to keep inflation down. And I think it will have learnt a valuable lesson from the last spike and not having acted in time. That obviously then doesn't spell great news for people hoping for rate cuts, for example, to boost their finances. The government doesn't appear to. Well, I'm going to choose my words carefully here. I really don't know what their plan is. I'm absolutely mystified as to what their plan is. It is apparently growth. Growth is inflationary. If they deliver the growth that they're planning on delivering, that will be inflationary. All of their plans appear to involve delivering growth many years in the future, whilst on the other hand, removing growth from the economy right now. So I have no idea what's going to happen there. I think we've bounced from one party that didn't really have an idea what it was doing to another party that doesn't really have an idea what it's doing. So let's just work on the basis that the government and the central bank aren't going to do you any favors. So what can you do about it? Well, firstly, it's the big stuff, budgeting, your household budget. Where does all your money go? We're going to do something on the podcast on this, I think, in the next few weeks. I think it's well worth revisiting this topic. But I think many of us get paid at the start of the month. Our essential bills, the mortgage, the bills and everything go out. We then spend our money through the month, and then we get down to basically zero or beyond zero. And then we get paid again at the end of the next month. And we're like, where's all my money go? But we don't actually go into the where does all my money go bit. And it does pay off, I think, periodically. I would say once a year to sit down and get a bit geeky. With the bank statements, with the spreadsheet, with a piece of paper, with a pen, with a budgeting app, however you want to do it, and work out where is all your money going? How much money have you got coming in each month? Obviously, this is easier if you're an employee than it is if you're self-employed. But if you're self-employed, you need to kind of work it out and average it out and do the best you possibly can to do that. And then work out where all your money is going out. What are the essentials? What are the non-essentials but regular spends, the lifestyle stuff, the stuff that, okay, you could, if you were going to be absolutely militant, you could cut it all out, but really you're not going to do that. So what's the kind of baseline level for that? And then what do you have left, or do you have anything left? Are you actually over? And then where can you try to trim things back? Sadly, the last time I did this, I discovered that there was way less places that I could potentially trim things back than I could. But it did mean that I was like, okay, I kind of refocused the mind. Then there's the other big stuff. For example, have you got expensive bills, expensive debts, you know, stuff that you could move to make them cheaper? You know, if you've got credit card debts, personal loans, things like that, you might be able to balance transfer them and pay them off on zero or lower interest. You know, maybe you could give up the expensive car finance. You might have the ability to switch your energy bills. You can do that. It's probably only going to save you £100 or a couple of £100. Your mortgage is the big one, but that's quite lumpy. It's like, are you at risk because you need to remortgage? And if you don't need to remortgage, great. You don't have to worry about it. But kind of think about when will you have to do that and plan ahead. And if you do have to remortgage, look into it 6 months in advance. You normally can. Good fee-free broker. We've got This Is Money's mortgage service at thisismoney.co.uk/mortgage-finder. You put in your house price, you put in your loan size, it will tell you the best loans you could apply for. You can speak to the broker, you can arrange that for free, add the fees to the loan, and then you've got it secured. And if rates go down in the meantime, you can switch to another loan. Doesn't matter, you haven't paid any money. But if rates go up in the meantime, then at least you've secured that. Savings, get all of your money into the best possible savings account, paying the best possible rate, and ideally a cash ISA so that you're not losing money to tax. Make it a flexible ISA. That's what I say. And then you should consider investing if you've got a large pot of cash, because investing has been proven to be the best way of beating inflation over time.
Fantastic advice, Simon. Talking of ISAs, reader question time. I'm 51 with an extra £150 a month to invest until I hope to retire at around 60. I'm already contributing to a workplace pension and I have a pot currently valued around £180,000. I expect to be a basic rate taxpayer on retirement. Is it better to A, invest that £150 in a pension with tax relief now, knowing I'll pay tax on the eventual income, or B, invest it in an ISA with no tax relief now, but no tax to pay on income? Tanya, appreciate your insight, says the reader.
The first thing to say is this is a nice position to be in, and both of the options this reader is presenting are good, sensible options. They're not suggesting doing anything crazy here. So you're not going to go far wrong. We got Ray Black, who is a very experienced financial advisor, to answer this one. And he really explained that it's about what your personal preference is in terms of accessing your money and how and when you want to pay tax, which the reader seems already to have grasped in terms of the ISA. You don't pay tax on the way out. You will pay tax on the way out. He goes through the pros and cons. Really, though, I think if you're just going for the biggest pot, the pension does win. And it's because of all the extra free money that goes in from the government, but also from your employer. And if you are with an employer that does matching contributions, you put in a bit more and they will up their own contributions, it is absolutely worth looking into that. And if you're not doing that and you can afford it, that would be the first thing to do, in my opinion, because it's free money you're leaving on the table if you don't do it. Ultimately, you probably would end up with a bigger pot at the end with a pension. He's retiring at 60 and he's 51 now, this reader. But the other side of that, and this the really big caveat, is people really prize access. They don't want their money to be tied up for a long time. The simplicity of an ISA and the accessibility, if that's what you prize most, you really think you might need the money for something before you're 60, then that would be the way to go. But yeah, no, Ray definitely concluded no wrong answers here, down to personal preference.
I mean, that was one thing that I looked at with this, was that, I mean, I'm not sure when he can access that workplace pension pot, but should something happen, I don't know if he's got an emergency savings pot there. So should something happen between now and when he can access that, he might have needed that extra.
He does say it's spare. that it's fair to invest. So I think we can assume that you would have some kind of emergency savings. It's 55 at the moment when you can access private pensions, but it's going up in 2028 to 57. That is a cliff edge. It is going to cause a lot of people concern. We're going to write about that more and more. I think in coming years, as we get closer to it, people are going to have a think about how they want to approach that, if they're in the right age group for it. If it's spare money, then he's got a lot of flexibility.
Fanny, I just want to ask you, because there's a lot of speculation. We mentioned it in the podcast, or we talked about it a lot in the podcast last week, about, you know, all this speculation, and it is speculation, but around changes to ISAs, particularly cash ISAs. But ISAs, you know, in tax relief do cost, I guess is the right word, the government about $6.7 billion a year. They wouldn't be too grumbly, would they, if ISAs became a little less generous? But they are still a useful tool for people's planning in latter years, aren't they?
ISAs are incredibly popular, and their great strength is they're really, really simple. So mess with them at your peril. It sounds like the news from the latest meeting is that Rachel Reeves isn't going to scrap cash ISAs. Well, that's good news. There might be some tinkering, though. The government definitely seems to be very keen to get us investing. Our readers have spoken on this. We ran a poll in a recent story and asked them what they thought. It was absolutely overwhelming. Leave it to us. We want to decide. There was a small cohort of people who were, OK, you can encourage us if you like, but still leave it to us. But that was about as far as our readers would like to go. And most of them were like, it's my money. My decision.
Simon?
This cutting back on cash ISAs thing is ridiculous, right? So, I mean, firstly, she appears to have confirmed to banks this week that she's not going to axe cash ISAs, which is lucky, really. I mean,
I didn't even know that was on the cards.
But she hasn't ruled out, like, lowering the limit. No. Lowering the cash ISA limit would be really stupid for a couple of reasons. One, people absolutely love cash ISAs. And unless Rachel Reeves doesn't want to be Chancellor anymore, she should leave them alone. If she doesn't want to be Chancellor anymore, then she could stage a raid on cash ISAs. But I think she does still want to be Chancellor. I think that actually she could still be a good Chancellor. So I don't think that Rachel Reeves is going to hack back the cash ISA limit. It would literally be just like waging war on a large chunk of, like, you know, middle class Britain. And also, you know, below that, there is this suggestion, oh, well, it's only the wealthy who benefit the most from it. But the fact of the matter is that personal savings allowance has not gone up since it was introduced. You only get £500 of interest tax-free if you're a higher rate taxpayer. The number of higher rate taxpayers has gone up hugely since the personal savings allowance was introduced. And we're going to keep freezing those thresholds. Beyond that as well, you used to have different amounts for cash ISAs and stocks and shares ISAs, and they got rid of that because it didn't work properly, and it was a problem in to improve the system. Why would you turn the system back however many years and make it worse again? That would be completely nuts. We're meant to be simplifying ISAs. This would actually make them more complicated. On top of that, the ISA limit also hasn't gone up in absolutely ages and should have gone up with inflation. And finally, even if you did cut back the amount that people can put into their cash ISAs, they're not going to invest it in the UK stock market instead. It's just going to go, it's going to sit in taxed accounts. So maybe the government will get a bit more tax, but that will come at the expense of being unbelievably unpopular. Off the back of hiking national insurance when it said wouldn't hike national insurance, waging war on farmers and people's pensions and all these other things, staging a raid on cash ISAs would be the dumbest thing that you could possibly do. But people won't invest that money in the UK stock market. The suggestions that they would do is coming from some, I don't know who the clowns are in the city that are suggesting this, but it's not the people involved in people's actual personal finances. The people involved in people's actual personal finances are just like, no, wouldn't go into the UK stock market. I mean, it probably wouldn't get invested anyway, or maybe a small amount of it would get invested instead. But if it did get invested, it ain't going into UK shares. It's not going to benefit UK companies. It'll end up in gigantic US tracker funds.
Yeah.
What's the point in that? Why would you cause so many ructions? So personally, I don't think it is going to change. I think we're safe. Now, I could be wrong. There is a percentage chance that somewhere there is a plan being cooked up to absolutely torpedo what's left of approval ratings. But I don't think there is that plan being cooked up.
I think if they did it, they would have to make it, they'd have to have a sweetener. They'd have to do something that encourages us to invest and to invest in the UK company. It does whiff a little bit of vested interest. Who are the city execs that are pushing this? Well, probably those ones that would get a bit of a cut should we all start investing, whether it's in the US or in the UK.
And I agree with you. I agree with you. Every single person probably in that room making that suggestion is on hundreds of thousands, if not millions of pounds a year. The cash ISA means nothing to them. They shouldn't get a say. The people who should get a say in this are ordinary savers.
But that's not to say, though, that Simon, that if you're young and you're happy with the risk and you have a long time horizon, that actually having a more US style retail investor culture might be better for us.
Oh, 100%. There's loads of people sitting on massive amounts in cash ISAs who should be investing their money instead. Money over and above their your rainy day savings fund and then some extra stuff on top of that, you should definitely consider investing. At the moment, you can get a decent return on a cash ISA. You can still get more than 5% on an easy access cash ISA, which is pretty fantastic. Those rates could obviously fall, but you can fix at like 4.5% roughly. That's a good return, but that should be the safe portion of your overall kind of, you know, wealth savings investments. And then you should be taking some more risk with the rest of it. Because as I said earlier, you know, reams of well-respected studies show that the best way of beating inflation and growing your wealth over time is investing in the stock market. And the reason behind that is really simple. It's because those companies take money and put it to productive use. And by putting it to productive use, they are able to profit and generate a return on their investment. Because if they couldn't do that, they'd just leave the money in cash as well, right? So they just put it into government bonds. They can't put it in a cash ISA, put it to government bonds and, you know, take the cash returns on it instead. But they believe that they can make more money on it. Now, not every company is going to make more money on it, but as a whole, the stock market chooses winners because the ones that aren't making money and are losing out slowly fall down the index and drop out of the index and maybe even fall out of the stock market altogether and go bust or get bought up. And the winners continue to go on. And if you look at a broad stock market index, and by which I don't mean the FTSE 100, I don't even really mean the FTSE All Share because that's only a very small chunk of the global market. If you look at the global stock market, you can see that in action year after year. But even if you look at the FTSE All Share, and arguably the UK stock market is cheap and people should seriously be considering investing in it. But those companies, every day, every week, every month, every year, are out there taking cash and using it to make a better return. And that's why backing them pays off. Not because someone's tinkering with your cash ISA now.
That's it for part one.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
Welcome back. What is it with government departments and IT? The aim, I presume, was to make it more straightforward to use its online tool, which helps you work out what you will retire on. This is all about state pension forecasts. Now, it appears, though, that the opposite has happened, leaving people more confused than before. And it all comes mere months ahead of a crucial deadline for a special deal to buy state pension top-ups and boost payments in retirement. Tanya, I mean, I assume this is to make things more straightforward. It would be a very stupid venture to make things less straightforward, but it seems like they've achieved it. What has been going on?
Yes, this was a bit of a kerfuffle at the end of last week. I think it was HMRC, but the DWP must have been involved as well. But for reasons best known to themselves, they decided to tinker with the state pension forecast system ahead of a big deadline coming up on top-ups. But we started getting emails about it. We got two emails within 8 minutes and I said, oh, what's going on here? So we immediately started investigating. It took a little while to work out what exactly they were doing because we had to ask people to see their forecast. We were looking up our own forecast. forecast in the office. Lee Boyce looked up his forecast for us. And what they seem to be doing is failing to understand what motivates people when they look at their forecast. The full state pension at the current rate is £221.20 a week. Obviously, it's going to go up in future years, but people want to know how close they are to getting that. What do they need to do to get to that point? And they've taken away some essential information where they didn't actually tell you how close you were to it. And if you had reached it, and this was crucial, if you had already reached the point where you had qualified for full state pension, it didn't tell you. In fact, it seemed to heavily imply that this is your state pension age, and to reach the full state pension, the implication that people were taking away from it was, I need to carry on contributing right up to that date when they don't. Now, some people will, because if you're in work, you may have qualified for a state pension and you carry on contributing via national insurance. But if you don't have to, if you want to retire, if you have caring responsibilities, if something else is going on in your life, you would like to know when you've hit that point where you've qualified for the full state pension and you don't need to put any more in. And especially with these top-ups, this top-ups deadline coming up, it was absolute madness to fiddle around with it. They ended up telling us, they did roll this back after 24 hours or so after we first got in touch with them, they U-turned on it. They did mention to us that they'd made about 8 tweaks to the forecast. So I think they were experimenting, to be honest. I'm only reading between the lines, but I have a feeling they were trying different things for different people, people who had qualified, people who hadn't qualified for the full state pension, that kind of thing, different approaches for different people. And our readers were so unimpressed. I cannot even tell you how cross and confused they were. They were baffled. That was the main thing.
So what have the government said? What have DWP said about this?
I can read you out their statement. Due to customer feedback, these changes have now been withdrawn. This means people will be able to view their state pension forecast as they were before. We apologise for any confusion caused.
Do you know what, Tanya? During that, I was like, I'm going to check my government gateway, right? See my state pension forecast. I mean, even if the thing worked properly, it is such a pain. Like, you have to remember what your government gateway is and then your password. And I always forget my password. And then it says, OK, well, fine, we'll get you another one. But you have to have a code. And then you have to have your Google authenticator. That doesn't work. And it's like you've got 5 attempts. And then in the end, it's like, call the HMRC number. I thought, no, just no, I'm not going to bother. What is it with government and IT? It drives me mad. Okay, so on that, though, the timing is particularly significant. You spoke to Steve Webb, Sir Steve Webb, pensions agony uncle for This Is Money, and he was particularly cross about the timing. Tell us a bit more about this deal to buy state pension top-ups and why it's the timing is so bad.
Yeah, Steve said he was astonished that they brought in this change with only weeks to go before this deadline. And he also questioned whether they'd done much user testing on it. That's quite strong for Steve. He's usually quite measured in what he says. But yeah, he was unimpressed too. So the top-ups deadline that is coming up is at the moment, you can fill in gaps going all the way back to 2006, so 18 years. From April the 5th, it's going to revert to 6 years. So that's obviously quite a big change for people who have been able to boost their state pension quite a lot at the current rates for some time. Last time this deadline approached was 2 years ago, and it was absolute chaos. There was a phone meltdown, basically. They ended up putting back the deadline twice, and the second time they put the deadline back to April 2025. They a whole 2 years, basically, just to get over it. They have since then brought in an online tool. So you can actually now purchase online in certain circumstances. Some people can't use it. If you're over state pension age, for instance, you can't use it. If you're trying to buy periods, filling gaps when you've worked overseas, you can't use it. And there's various opt-outs. But if you're a fairly straightforward user with a straightforward national insurance record, you should be able to use this tool. The only issue with that is the purchase might work, but we're already starting to hear from people who are being told by HMRC staff that it's taking 8 weeks to allocate the money once it's been paid to your national insurance account. And then it needs to go to the DWP and they will recalculate your state pension forecast or payments. And the latest report we've had on that is that people have been quoted 6 months. Wow. Which I don't know whether that's true or not. That might be one staff member who's just trying to lower expectations. We are going to be asking more questions about this, obviously. The thing about it is, for the people who are going to pay the money and their forecast is going to change because they're not reaching state pension age for many years, that's going to be really annoying. They're going to be cross because their money will have disappeared. There'll be no change on their forecast for ages. They will certainly be in touch with us if it's going to take that long. But the people who are going to be most frustrated are the ones who are over state pension age and want to see a difference in their payments for their money. Mm-hmm. It dates from the point where you actually pay for the top-ups. So you would get the backdating, but it's the waiting and the not knowing if your money has got lost at some point between the to and froing between the DWP and HMRC. I continue to say that it is really mad to have two departments shuttling these cases back and forth between them. I realise that there's not going to be a merger between the DWP and HMRC. I'm not asking for that, but I do think there should be one department with one boss where people are seconded from the DWP and they're seconded from HMRC and they both work in a single joined up department under one boss. They can still be paid by the separate departments, still be belong to the separate departments, but in for something like this, which is so important to people's pensions, I really do think that there must be a better way to run it.
Hear, hear, Tanya, hear, hear. Right, poor old Lee. The news this week that premium bonds are, well, less premium. NS&I will cut the underlying rate again, the fourth time since they hit a high of 4.65%. The April 2025 draw rate will be 3.8%. Now, the odds remain at 22,000 to 1, as do the two £1 million jackpot prizes. But it does mean there will be fewer bigger prizes, so like 100,000, 50,000, all that sort of thing. NS&I is also cutting the rates on its popular income bonds and direct saver, but it is bumping up its cash ISA rate. So, Simon, the reason I said poor old Lee is because I don't think he's won on the premium bonds for about 2 years.
No, he said that the other week, didn't he? Yeah, bemoaning his lot. So his rate's much lower. NS&I adjusts its rates to do a number of things, to sort of manage how much money it's pulling in. So NS&I is there to raise money for the government, basically. It's like an alternative to government borrowing. It reacts, obviously, to interest rate decisions as well by the Bank of England, so and the expectations for future interest rates. We've had a Bank of England rate cut. And it also tries to not massively skew the savings market, because obviously NS&I is attractive for a reason that other banks aren't attractive, which is that it's 100% backed by the government. So your money in there is safe as long as the UK doesn't go bust. So it's greater than the savings compensation that you would get elsewhere. Premium bonds also have an added benefit in that the prices are tax-free. So you can compare them really to an ISA more than a standard savings account. NS&I appears to have decided it wants to be taking a little bit less money in, also reacting to the Bank of England base rate cut, as I said. You might think that's a little bit strange at a time when we are having to borrow quite a lot of money and government borrowing costs are quite high, but you know, these are the things, the way these things work. For what it means for savers is, if you have money in premium bonds, you now need to make a decision as to whether you should put it elsewhere, because the rate has declined and it looks less favourable compared to those best deals that you can get on a standard savings account, particularly on a cash ISA, which, as I said earlier, you can pick up 5% on. What it means in practice for most savers with premium bonds is that they'll do absolutely nothing and leave their money in premium bonds, because that's what people do with premium bonds. Now, from my own personal perspective, as someone who has premium bonds, here's what I'm going to do. Absolutely nothing and leave my money in premium bonds. But I tell you what I did do. I logged into my NS&I online account, which is not the easiest thing to do because you need your NSNI number and then there's a number of hoops to jump through. For the
easier than Government Gateway, though, I'm telling you.
For the after not managing to get into it for the umpteenth time, last time round I actually wrote down my NSNI number. So when I went to do it the other day, I suddenly thought to myself, oh, I need to know my bloody NSNI number. And then I thought, hang on, I wrote it down. Then I thought,
Where?
Did I write it down? My phone? On a random piece of paper? On a newspaper that was on my desk? Anyway, I found the NSNI number, added up all the prizes that I've had over the last year, which has been a decent like run of prizes in terms of the number of prizes. There are quite a few kind of small, they're all small value prizes mainly. Worked out my rate of return based on how much money I had in the premium bonds a year ago and what I've earned on it over a year. 3.7%. So I've been doing worse than the average and slightly worse than this current rate that they've just reduced it to, which means that if I do move back up towards the average, my rate will improve. But the other reason I'm just leaving my money in premium bonds is that's where I keep my rainy day savings. That's my kind of emergency fund pot. And you can get premium bond cash within basically one or two working days. So it's pretty much instant access, but there's enough of a hurdle to get at that cash that you can't spend it as easily as money that you potentially had in a true easy access savings account or easy access cash ISA, flexible cash ISA. So that's where I keep my rainy day pot. And that's why it's going to stay there. Going back to the point that we made about cash ISAs and investing earlier, there are quite a sizable chunk of people, though, with the maximum amount in premium bonds, the 50 grand or 40 to 50 grand. And I do think that some of those people should potentially be looking at whether they should be putting some of that money elsewhere to make it work harder. But I do know what most of them will do. Absolutely nothing.
But it's the excitement as well, though, isn't it? It's just like, it's not like a normal savings account. It's like every month you go, ooh, have I won?
Oh, yeah. And as the kind of like deluded optimist who still plays the lottery because he knows his numbers and so has has been playing the lottery for so long, he knows his numbers and it's like a bad episode of Lost going on in my head. So I have a direct debit to play the damn lottery twice a week. I'm exactly the kind of fool who thinks that they might win £1 million one day.
One day. Okay, maybe not a million, but what about £100? Nationwide customers keen for £100 payout via its Fairer Share payment scheme this year should take steps now to ensure that they don't miss out. Now, last year, a total of £385 million was paid to almost 4 million nationwide members. That was up from £340 million for 3.4 million members the year before. They have substantially more customers than that, so it's all about eligibility criteria. Will they do it for the third year running? Don't know. We don't know much details about the scheme for this year. Are there things that you can do? Yes, probably. But first, what is Fairer Share?
Fairer Share involves Nationwide paying its members a bonus. Nationwide is a building society, so people who count as members, so if they've got a mortgage or savings account, effectively they own the building society. It makes quite a lot of money. Most of those members don't see most of that money. But Nationwide says it gives it back to them in the form of better mortgage and savings rates. But it obviously has to, you know, do something about that and control those, because otherwise it would be totally swamped. So that's why it doesn't just pay you 7% on your savings, if you remember. So one idea it came up with in recent years was the Fairer Share payment, which meant that qualifying members would get £100. And this was massive. People absolutely loved this. The stories we've done on this, absolutely huge traffic. However, quite a lot of people were a bit grumpy because they didn't actually qualify. So in order to qualify, right, you need to have a current account, and you need to make at least two payments out of your current account in the first 3 months of this year. Now, you will have, or you could qualify by making at least 10 payments out of the current account in 2 out of 3 months of January 2025, February 2025, March 2025. So basically, if you've got a Nationwide current account, make sure you're using it, okay? Secondly, you need to have £100 in a savings account. So get £100 into one of the qualifying savings accounts, because otherwise you might miss out. This is a public service announcement, okay? In the last 2 years to qualify, customers needed to have had at least £100 in a Nationwide savings account or cash ISA at the end of any day in March. March is now 7 days away, so make it something that you do if you're a Nationwide current account customer, is get that money in there, unless you've got a Nationwide mortgage, and then you qualify. Just put £100 in the account, leave it sitting there, and then if they pay the fairer share and they use the same criteria as last year, then you should qualify. If they use different criteria, well, you know what? At least you tried. But just do it, basically. And I say this as someone who needs to do this himself, because I nearly missed out last year because I moved my cash ISA from Nationwide because I could get a better rate from elsewhere. Luckily, it moved after the 1st of March. But if it hadn't have done, I would have been a Nationwide current account holder who didn't have any money in a savings account, and I wouldn't have got my fair share bonus. But as it was, because I did, and we're a joint account, we got £200 off them.
Nice. Talking about wins, do we have a winner for the mug of the week? It's not the mug of the week. It's the question of the week or the comment of the week.
Yeah, we do. Don't think we did this. I don't know what Lee did last week. Did he do
one
last week?
Yeah, we did. Oh, yes, we did.
Was it about overpaying your mortgage or car finance?
I can't remember, Simon. I can't remember what happened yesterday.
All right, well, I'm going to do overpaying your mortgage or car finance. But if we did that last week as well, then that's going to be a problem. So I'm going to listen to the end of last week. I'm going to listen to the end of last week's podcast after this. And if I email you and say, take the question out, just take the question out. We won't do the question, okay?
Oh, why not? We'll just do it again. People, you know, I'm sure we have new listeners coming in. Hang on. It's one that starts off saying, let me first off by saying a huge thank you to This Is Money team for the amazing podcast. Well, if you haven't started your email like that, I'm not interested. Okay. Get rid of it, Simon.
Right. Okay. Here is the question of the week, including the preamble that gets you past Georgie and her need for constant compliments.
Validate me.
Yeah. Welcome to Validate Georgie of the Week. Hi. As an avid listener to your podcast. Oh,
lovely.
An avid listener to your podcast.
Oh, lovely.
I often hear myself asking questions to you through the radio waves. There you go. That's hitting a number of Georgie buttons there. Radio waves.
That's so good.
Loves the radio. Therefore, I thought it might be better to email and ask. We remortgaged our house a couple of years back before the interest rate hike and managed to fix our mortgage for 5 years at 1.7%. Bearing in mind, I also have a PCP car on finance. Am I better off overpaying the mortgage or overpaying my car finance whilst avoiding the overpay charges? That's from Matt. Good question. Really? Crucial bit of the question, whilst avoiding the overpay charges. So you are almost certainly better off paying off your PCP car finance, because I'm going to hazard a guess that it's more expensive than your mortgage. You don't quote the rate here, but it's almost certainly more expensive than your mortgage. You should clear your most expensive debts first. The PCP car finance will be a smaller amount, but you will be paying a higher rate on it. What you're effectively doing with car PCP is you're funding the depreciation on the car. So if you do it over 3 years, a calculation will be done. Price you buy the car for, price the car's going to be worth in 3 years, and you fund that depreciation with interest added on top. And then at the end of that, you've got the opportunity to make the balloon payment and take ownership of the car or hand it back. If it was a brand new car, there is a possibility it might be really cheap finance. If it was a used car, it's probably going to be more expensive. So it could be that actually the PCP finance is lower than the 1.7% on the mortgage, in which case mortgage is the better bet. Go for the higher, the more expensive debt first, and always, as we said, avoid those overpaying charges.
Lovely. Thank you very much, Simon. And finally, stat of the week.
Simon looks up a stat of the week. Right, stat of the week. This one is a basically pretty much straightforward. Centrica, British gas owner Centrica. It revealed this week that its profits had taken a nosedive in its household energy arm. That's the British gas bit. And that's because it's not getting energy crisis subsidies anymore. However, its shares are up really quite substantially over from their 2020 lows. They are up 300% from their 2020 lows. But how much below the peak of Centrica shares are Centrica shares? 64%.
Ooh.
That's back on 2013. So if you had bought Centrica shares in 2013, they would not have paid off.
No, that's a good stat, Simon. I liked it. That's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. Send us in your question of the week and we will try to answer it. Come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past and look us up on social media.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.